It's Thursday, December 2nd. The Supreme Court could be open to scrapping abortion rights. We start here. How far will the conservative justices go?
If it really is an issue about choice, why is 15 weeks not enough time?
What they said from the bench and the big moments from the historic day at the court. Omicron is officially here.
There's so little that we know about this variant.
Doctors in California identify the first case of the new COVID-19 variant, but is it actually something to be concerned about? And new details about the deadly school shooting in Michigan.
I texted them both and I was like, there's a shooter at my school. I heard gunshots. I just want you guys to know that I love you.
Students texting their families in the moment. The suspect now in court. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Mary Alice Parks. Hey again, Brad is off. I'll be with you again this morning.
Any decision that allows courts to override and to violate our basic rights is an unacceptable one.
It was arguably the most important and consequential day in court for abortion rights and anti-abortion rights advocates since Roe versus Wade was decided.
And I thank you for the hard work you're going to continue to do in a post-Roe v. Wade world. Post!
The arguments before the Supreme Court yesterday lasted just under 2 hours, and they were fascinating, almost halting in how frank they were, blunt and to the point, though the topic of discussion and decision at hand is so huge. For instance, this was how Mississippi's Solicitor General started.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey haunt our country. They have no basis in the Constitution. They have no home in our history or traditions.
And not only did he ask the 9 Supreme Court justices to uphold a law in his state that would ban abortions after 15 weeks, that's before the point in a pregnancy when a fetus could survive outside the womb, but like we talked about yesterday and you heard there, he asked the court to consider fundamentally rejecting the idea that a woman has a constitutional right to terminate a pregnancy at all. And on the other side,
this philosophical disagreements can't be resolved in a way that a woman has no choice in the matter. And
two women arguing together. That contrast not lost on people listening. The director of litigation for the Center of Reproductive Rights put her defense of abortion access in stark terms, too.
Women have an equal right to liberty under the Constitution, Your Honor. And if they're not able to make this decision, if states can take control of women's bodies and force them to endure months of pregnancy and childbirth, then they will never have equal status under the Constitution.
I want to bring in our senior Washington reporter, Devin Dwyer, who covers the Supreme Court and has done just extensive reporting on this case. Devin, first, tell us about the scene at the court yesterday, and how did the justices respond to these arguments?
Yeah, Mary Alice, outside the court, a surreal and dramatic scene. Thousands of people turned out.
Abortion bans have got to go!
I haven't seen that many demonstrators from both sides of an issue show up there in years.
Empower women! Promote life!
Inside the court, some people speculated perhaps the court would hold the cards close to its chest, try to find some sort of a middle ground. That didn't turn out to be the case, and in fact, it looked like a very good day yesterday for the state of Mississippi and their 15-week ban on abortions.
We will hear argument this morning in case 19-1392, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization.
The power center of this court were the three justices to watch, and that is Roberts, Amy Coney Barrett, and Justice Brett Kavanaugh.
If you think that the issue is one of choice, that women should have a choice to terminate their pregnancy, that supposes that there is a point at which they've had the fair choice.
Justice John Roberts seemed to be trying to bait some of his colleagues to come along with a compromise route.
So viability, it seems to me, doesn't have anything to do with choice. But if it really is an issue about choice, why is 15 weeks not enough time?
He asked a lot of questions about the viability line, whether perhaps there might be some way to modify that line.
I'd like to focus on the 15-week ban because that's not a dramatic departure from viability.
Maybe they take up some version of the Planned Parenthood versus Casey decision from 1992, which said, you know, states can't set undue burdens on women seeking abortion. Maybe they modify that. But there weren't any takers.
The Constitution's neither pro-life nor pro-choice on the question of abortion.
The fetus has an interest in having a life, and that doesn't change, does it, from the point before viability to the point after viability?
Amy Coney Barrett was a little bit harder to read.
So petitioner points out that in all 50 states, you can terminate parental rights by relinquishing a child after abortion. And I think the shortest period might have been 48 hours, if I'm remembering the data correctly.
She signaled at a couple points that she really didn't think the reliance interests on precedent were that significant for women. In fact, she talked a lot about these so-called safe haven laws. You know, the argument on the other side of this whole thing, Mary Alice, really boils down to stare decisis. Let the decision stand. And that is something that Justice Stephen Breyer, the court's most senior liberal, an ardent defender of the institution of the Supreme Court, really keyed in on.
To reexamine a watershed decision would subvert the court's legitimacy beyond any serious question.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor standing up, taking that role that one could imagine Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg would have taken.
Will this institution survive the stench that this creates in the public perception?
She spoke at length about the impact that this would have on women and the importance of preserving precedent, which she made a huge point of saying has been in place for 50 years.
Now, the sponsors of this bill, the House bill in Mississippi, said we're doing it because we have new justices.
And so, Devin, what happens next?
Well, the oral argument in a case is the first time the justices get to hear from each other on the issues at play. So they don't talk about it beforehand. And yesterday was the first chance they all got to hear from each other. So that conversation is now going to continue in private. They'll take an initial vote on the case and begin writing their opinions. The opinion writing process can take months. It's dynamic. In fact, there are plenty of prominent examples of when the justices can even change their minds during that process. So this will continue for some time behind closed doors. We won't get a final decision, though, until next spring, most likely before the end of June.
I have to ask you, too, about Texas, because we've had this this incredibly strict law on the books in Texas and the country sort of waiting to see if the court was going to weigh in on that and let it stand and stay in effect. Did that come up at all?
Yeah, it was fascinating. I mean, SB 8, that law that received so much attention, has dominated the headlines for the past 3 months, did not come up at all.
Justices heard two challenges to the Texas abortion law, which bars most abortions in the state after 6 weeks of pregnancy.
Since the court heard those rare urgent arguments, they have remained silent in that case. And now the expectation is that perhaps they're going to combine the two. Perhaps the reasoning in this Mississippi case will shed some light on how they'll dispose of the Texas case. And the practical implication of that, Mary Alice, is that, you know, abortion access in the second most populous state in this country will likely be out of reach for millions of women at least several months longer.
Devin Dwyer really helping us understand how it all played out yesterday. Devin, thank you.
Thanks, Marielle.
Next up on Start Here, the White House today is rolling out policies around masking and travel for the winter. What you need to know after the break.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
In case you missed it at the top, it is actually December this week. Crazy, I know. That means winter is basically here. And now we know that that new COVID variant, Omicron, definitely is. Experts say the patient identified in the U.S. with the new variant was fully vaccinated but not boosted, had mild symptoms, and is already improving.
The person recently traveled to South Africa and developed symptoms upon their return. And they did the right thing and got tested and reported their travel history.
Still, the White House is eager to show that they are paying attention. And even if we don't know a lot yet about the seriousness of the variant, the winter months could lead to a spike in cases with the holidays and people inside.
This new variant
is a cause for concern, but not a cause for panic.
So the White House is rolling out a new COVID plan for the season. I want to go now to Ann Flaherty, our senior national policy reporter. So, Ann, what is this new plan from the White House?
President Biden wants to assure the American public that he has everything under control. So he has this extensive plan he's going to talk about today. And I think there are really three big things that most Americans really want to know or should know about this plan. One is free at-home tests for everyone. So these are those $25 boxes at the local pharmacy that's been in short supply that everybody's been trying to get their hands on.
We all wanted to get tested, make sure, you know, we're gathering together. We don't have COVID. Everyone's safe and sound.
I feel that it's my responsibility that when I'm visiting with other people, I'd like to know that I'm not the one that's responsible for anybody getting sick.
The administration is going to rely on a law that says testing has to be free through your insurance, and they're going to say that come mid-January, you can ask your insurance company to reimburse you for that.
I wear my mask if I'm indoors with other people. I don't always know whether they're all vaccinated or not. That's just good practice.
You know, the other thing is the masks. He's not asking states to impose mask mandates, which I found interesting, but he is going to keep that mask mandate for transit, flying or riding a bus at least through March. And of course, starting next week, they've talked a little bit about this in the past, but this is a new requirement that you have to test one day before flying into the United States from overseas. You already have to be vaccinated. This is a new rule that takes effect. It tightens that timeline for when people can test before they get on a plane from overseas.
Let me repeat what the doctors and scientists have affirmed. The best protection against Omicron is getting a booster shot.
The other thing, Mary Alice, that I think that they're doing is just trying to push this idea of boosters. It's boosters, boosters, boosters. If you have any doubt about whether or not you should get it, the senior administration officials are telling us this is a full court press. They're going to try to expand capacity at pharmacies, get pharmacies to start texting and calling eligible customers to really make this as easy as possible.
I want the board to consider expanding the optional use, but strongly encouraged, of face coverings throughout the entire district.
And one last thing that I think is important that parents will probably be interested in is that CDC is rethinking this rule that they've had that any quarantine from school should be 14 days. If your child is sitting next to someone who has had COVID, been tested positive, that your child is knocked out for 14 days in a quarantine. They are looking at this new practice called test to stay, which means basically if your child is a close contact, they could test. And if it's negative, they could stay in school. You know, I think that's a bone that the Biden administration is throwing to a lot of parents who are really tired of this. They really want to keep their kids in school. 14-day quarantines are extraordinarily disruptive to a child's education, and they're acknowledging that. We don't have an answer yet. They just said that they're willing to look at it, and we're going to hear from them in a couple weeks.
Did you get the sense on this background call with the White House officials that this plan was largely developed in response to the new variant, or really was something they had been working on? You know, it's hard to know if this variant is so much of a concern that it would warrant changing plans dramatically yet. Where do they seem to fall on that?
Well, I think that's exactly right. There's so little that we know about this variant. I think we're weeks away from knowing, even from basic lab data, what exactly, how transmissible this is. And it's going to be weeks more before we get real world kind of data to see what we're dealing with.
Doctor also says it's actually a good thing that Omicron is in the United States because now we have a viable sample. And that can give scientists the opportunity to determine whether this variant is in fact more transmissible and more virulent.
So, you know, I just think that they're trying to hand the American public a plan, something that they can hold on to say like, okay, my government's got this.
We should all be acting as hopefully we were yesterday, which is that Omicron is here. We need to get those vaccines and boosters. Get tested if you have symptoms or you know that you've been exposed and continue to wear those masks.
It isn't an alarm bell yet. It's a huge question mark.
This president has made the vaccine widely available. He's relied on the health, the advice of his health and medical experts, and he is trying to be a part of solving this crisis.
I will tell you what I think is interesting, what's not in this plan, is that they're not talking about vaccine mandates for domestic flights yet. They're being very cautious to avoid that, saying that we think we have a plan that makes everything as safe as possible. But I think that they know that political backlash that comes with mandates.
And Dr. Fauci joined the White House briefing yesterday, too, and he said that he's planning to enjoy the holidays pretty normal, maskless, as long as he knows that the group he's with has all been vaccinated. And Flaherty, the only one in the D.C. Bureau that I go to if I need to know both the science and the policy, everything that the White House and the administration is doing. And thank you.
Thanks, Mary Alice.
Another teenager shot Tuesday in Oxford, Michigan, has died, bringing the death toll from that devastating school shooting earlier this week to 4, while 3 students remain in the hospital.
An unimaginable tragedy and just...
Michigan's governor, Gretchen Whitmer, got emotional addressing the news and the epidemic of gun violence in her state and across the country.
I think this is every parent's worst nightmare.
And I can tell you that I found myself emotional, too. I was fighting back tears when I read texts from an 11th grader, Caitlin Bilby, to her dad. She wrote, "Dad, I love you."
And I was like, "There's a shooter at my school. I heard gunshots. I just want you guys to know that I love you. And you guys mean so much to me. Thank you for everything you do."
I can only imagine her fear in that moment. Caitlin sharing her text telling ABC that she texted her dad because she was worried she might die. Trevor All is on the ground for ABC News. He's been talking to members of the community. Trevor, what can you tell us about the victims? And what has law enforcement learned about the shooting?
Well, Mary Alice, unfortunately, this was already the deadliest school shooting of 2021, and now we have added yet another student to the list of people who were killed. 15-year-old Justin Schilling died at the hospital. He was the co-captain of the Oxford bowling team there, a golfer. He joins the list, unfortunately, of now 4 people who were shot and killed in this shooting rampage, along with 16-year-old Tate Meyer, a football player, 14-year-old Hannah St. Juliana, an artist, and 17-year-old Madison Baldwin, who we know was on her way to go off to college. And all of these young students had bright futures, and everyone is reflecting on what great people they were.
Multiple agencies responding to the call of an active shooter, ambulances in the driveway.
I heard like some people like screaming and like running away.
I had 911 dialed, I called them. I didn't even really get to say anything. I just kind of said Oxford High School.
We heard from the sheriff that this happened so quickly that he didn't even necessarily think that a lot of these shooting victims were even aware that someone was there with a gun at first when they were shot.
So with the PA, we hear our principal, Mr. Wolf, shouting, "Alice, lockdown, Alice, lockdown." And then we heard the gunshots in the class.
The fact that the school went into lockdown so quickly and law enforcement arrived so quickly certainly saved lives.
The way barricades were created, to where chairs and desks and things were moved, the way doors were locked down with devices that had been installed and purchased by the school district.
But still, we are left once again with 4 students dead in a school shooting and still 6 other students who were wounded and a teacher along with that, Mary Alice.
And Trevor, there's been a lot of focus on that absolutely terrifying social video. You see the students trying to talk to someone on the other side of the door. They barricaded themselves in the classroom.
Sheriff's office, they can come out.
They're skeptical about whether they're actually being given an all clear.
We're not taking that risk right now. Okay, well, come to the door and look at my bag, bro.
No. Yeah, bro.
He said bro.
Red flag.
And the video is so scary because you feel how panicked they are. They're just trying to make the best decision they can.
Go.
They decide they don't feel safe. You see them go out the window. They're responding in real time to these threats. Law enforcement is now saying that that was not actually the suspect on the other side of the door talking to them, but a lot of attention on this. What else can you tell us?
Yeah, well, I mean, everybody was sharing this video because you're absolutely right. It perfectly encapsulates the mindset of these students who are in the middle of this horrifying situation, and it really does seem like it might be the shooter.
More than likely, it was one of our plainclothes detectives, and he may have been talking, bro, in a conversational manner to try to bring them down from the crisis.
You can see in that video, it speaks to one of the charges against this suspected shooter, who's now charged with terrorism along with murder, because what prosecutors and what law enforcement continued to stress is this was a school of 1,800 students, and all of their families, all of them were, almost by definition, terrorized. And you can watch that in these young students literally fleeing for their lives here.
Oxford High School officials met with the teen and his parents about concerning behavior just hours before the shooting.
The content of that meeting obviously is part of the investigation.
Law enforcement is looking into what the school might have known and what they did and did not know, though the sheriff basically told me that this school shooting did not seem to be on anyone's radar. Having said that, we have heard from a law enforcement official who tells us that investigators are actively pursuing some information about the possibility that the night before the shooting, some of the students there saw a Snapchat video that was warning of a school shooting the following day. And we have already heard from some students who stayed home.
Cell phone taken in a search warrant depicted a video made by him the night before the incident, wherein he talked about shooting and killing students the next day at Oxford High School.
No tips, no calls were made to police ahead of time. But that all falls under the umbrella of what now law enforcement is looking into.
No word yet on motive, and there was no struggle during the arrest.
His parents have hired an attorney and told him not to speak with police.
I also want to ask you, too, about the suspect, a 15-year-old, but being charged as an adult here. Law enforcement saying that they think this was premeditated. We saw the arraignment. What else can you tell us about the investigation at this point, how he got the weapon? How's this playing out?
Everyone, from start to finish, who is making these decisions seem to be on board with charging this 15-year-old as an adult and wanting to find some kind of maximum punishment to get maximum justice for what has played out here. And now the next question, Mary Alice, also is, could this 15-year-old's parents face charges?
The sheriff says the suspect's father bought the gun, a 9mm pistol used in the crime 4 days ago.
There are, of course, laws, though. If you have that kind of weapon and you have a minor in your home, it needs to be locked up securely so the minor can't access it. So that's also partially what we're watching, on top of the fact that this 15-year-old now is facing multiple murder charges and a terrorism charge, Mary Alice.
All right, Trevor All on the ground for us there, digging into all the details of this. Trevor, I know you'll stay on it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take one more quick break, but when we come back, the fungus among us, how scientists want to map not the ground, but what's beneath. One last thing is next. And one last thing. We know some people love to forage for fungi.
There is no way.
Alexis Nicole Nelson, also known as the Black Forager, they're so excited about finding chicken of the woods mushrooms.
Lytiporus sulfurus, as evidenced by the yellow pore.
But when you're walking on the ground, do you ever think about what's below? The fungi right below your feet? A team of scientists from Amsterdam and Zurich have launched a new initiative to map the extensive networks of fungi in the soil all around us.
The winter chanterelle,
lion's mane,
Gryphula frondosa,
hedgehog mushrooms,
chanterelles and black trumpets.
It's referred to as like the coral reefs of dirt. Apparently, it's winding, miles-long, tiny networks that play a huge role in our ecosystems. They move nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus from one plant to another. They support all this life above ground. And maybe best of all, they apparently store all this carbon for long periods of time. So the research team is saying they want to enlist people to be cartographers.
We're gearing up to save trillions of kilometers of fungal network that are threatened by human impact and climate extremes.
They will use soil samples to actually try to create maps of these networks to better understand them and protect them and help fight climate change. If we know how trees are talking to each other, sharing and trading between each other, maybe we can protect them better or at least appreciate it all more. The segment is totally dedicated to my sister, who on her wedding day led us all on a hike in this temperate rainforest where she described nurse logs. Those are trees that have fallen but basically pump out nutrients to help everyone else nearby. Nature is so cool. I love thinking about this invisible, life-giving web supporting plants right there. And yesterday was pretty fun for us. A lot of you giving us love, telling us that Start Here was among your favorite podcasts in your Spotify wraps. So that's awesome to hear. Thanks to all of you who said it was your most listened to podcast. Spotify also selected Life Out Loud with LZ Granderson as one of the best new podcasts of 2021. Very cool indeed. So be sure to check that out. I'm Mary Alice Parks. Brad's back tomorrow. I'll see you later.